Welcome to the APA Podcast, where we help one another follow Jesus at home, in our city, and around the world.
Morning. I am wearing my Father's Day shirt, and I think I wear this shirt every year on Father's Day, and then it goes back on the hanger in the closet until next Father's Day. So I think it's about 6 years old, and I've worn it six times, but we made a deal, by the way, me and Pastor Nick, that we would both wear Hawaiian shirts today, and Pastor Nick is wearing black, and I am wearing this. So someone needs to hold that guy accountable. But it's good to be here. Happy Father's Day, and just wonderful to be in church together. Question to start off today. What are you doing to prepare for your future? What are you doing to prepare for your future? I've been in two car accidents in the last 9 months. Two. Once in September, and once on Wednesday. neither of them were my fault. I got rear-ended both times. Both times, basically in the same spot on the highway between Abbotsford and Langley. Both times, I was going to meet the same person. So I'm learning my lesson. I'm fine, don't worry. The first one almost totaled my car. This most recent one was a little bit less terrible. But anyways, I'm fine. Thankfully, neither were too serious. But even small situations like that make you think about your mortality, make you think about the future. And as a father, it makes me think about my wife and kids. If something were to happen to me, have I prepared their future to be able to survive without me? So thankfully, Rebecca and I, years ago, we took out a life insurance policy. And so there's things kind of set in place there. By the way, if something does happen to me and there's any mystery associated with it, just ask her a couple of questions before you move on, right? But you know, we've prepared for the future in that way. But a lot of popular wisdom today, you know, it's carpe diem, live in the moment, seize the day, which is positive if what you mean by living in the moment is being present, right? Not just, you know, looking at a screen and thinking about other moments or wondering about your to-do list for tomorrow, but living in the moment to be present with the people around you is very important and an important value. But if what you mean by seize the day is party hard now and forget about tomorrow, then that's an unwise way to live. But it's popular wisdom right now. Sometimes I like to remind myself to think about the future by saying this statement to myself: be kind to your future self. Dave, be kind to your future self. We're gonna have Pop in the lobby after church today, and it's gonna be fun just to hang out and connect. But one, my favorite soft drink of choice these days is Coke Zero. And the reason is that this dad bod doesn't mean the extra sugar and calories, you know, with regular Coke, so Coke Zero. But I like it straight from the can. I don't want you to pour it in a cup with ice. I just want to drink it from the can, which means it needs to have been in the fridge so that it's nice and cold. So if I want a nice cold Coke Zero today, I will have had to think yesterday or earlier to put it in the fridge. And so if past Dave was too lazy to put some Cokes in the fridge, present Dave is sad. So sometimes present Dave pulls a nice cold Coke out of the fridge and, thank you, past Dave, for thinking of me today. I was kind to my future. You know what I'm talking about? Be kind. Think about what you're going to need tomorrow. Think about what your family is going to need tomorrow. Think about what your church is going to need tomorrow. Think about the future and be prepared for it. We've been surveying the life of Joseph in the book of Genesis in this last series in our survey of the whole book. And we've seen him thinking about the future, having foresight through dreams that God provided him about what was going to come in the future. And Joseph's life is really a case study of human potential, case study of what it looks like to really lean into the calling as an image bearer to wisely rule as a vice regent of God. That's what image bearers were. Genesis 1 says, I will make them in my image, and he gives them the command to rule over the earth. So Joseph is living out this calling as an image bearer, and he's really the ideal human, and he's God is working through him as he does. God chooses human partners to work through to bring about his blessing and accomplish his purposes in the world. And here Joseph is, a faithful human partner, elevated to a high status in Egypt, whereby he is able to prepare the nation for a devastating famine that's about to come. God gave Pharaoh dreams that foretold the coming of 7 years of abundance and then 7 years of devastating famine, so bad that the 7 years of abundance would be forgotten. And here's Joseph laying out a plan so that the nation can be repaired. His plan wasn't to live in the moment and just enjoy the abundance of the 7 years. Who cares about the future? Guys, we've got some extra stuff. Let's party. Let's spend it. Let's do it. But no, he used the resources in order to prepare for the future. So of course, in God's providence, we also see that this plan served as an act of salvation to save Joseph's family, the family that had betrayed him. And we're going to get back to his family as we conclude next week, but for today, we're looking at how Joseph finalizes the application of his plan. So this is where we are. The 7 years of abundance are over. The famine has begun. The people from all over, not just Egypt, but from Canaan as well, are coming to Joseph for help. He's selling them food that he's stored up. And here we see his wisdom paying off. We're in Genesis 47, starting in verse 13. Meanwhile, the famine became so severe that all the food was used up, and the people were starving throughout the lands of Egypt and Canaan. By selling grain to the people, Joseph eventually collected all the money in Egypt and Canaan, and he put the money in Pharaoh's treasury. So here we're witnessing the wisdom of Joseph. Most people, a lot of us, if we were to experience a sudden increase in resources, we would spend it really quick. You know, you get a raise, maybe inheritance, you win the lottery, the money comes in, the money goes out. We've all heard the stories of lottery winners who get a whole bunch of money and then they start spending, and within a few years they're basically bankrupt, right? We've heard those stories. And I think because a lot of us who are kind of grinding it out to live paycheck to paycheck, if all that money came in, we don't really have the skills to know what to do with it. And so, you know, you buy the big house, but you forget that the big house also comes with a much bigger annual property tax bill and maintenance costs and all these year-over-year expenses once the money's gone will bankrupt you. So a lot of us, we get all that money and we just spend it right away. But that's not what Joseph did. He saw that all this extra resource was actually a gift from God to prepare for the future. And only Joseph had the wisdom to do this. All of the people of Egypt, all of them, they had 7 years of abundant crops. And yet within the first year, they start coming to Joseph, we have no food. Sometimes people tend to claim to be victims of bad circumstances. Unexpected bills, the economy softens, kids' braces, the roof sprung a leak. But sometimes lack of resources today are actually because of a lack of yesterday's foresight. Or in a time when we did have more than enough, we weren't thinking about the future where we might actually have less than enough, and so maybe we should prepare for that. So while the main point of the story isn't a lesson in making an investment and saving for a rainy day, there's certainly an opportunity to consider what we're doing with what God has given us. Joseph here, he's selling grain to the people, and we're told he collected all the money in Egypt and Canaan. Think about that. He collected all of the money. The word is actually silver. He collected all of the silver in Egypt and Canaan. Now, if you remember back earlier in the story, Joseph was sold by his brothers to be a slave in Egypt for what? A handful of silver. And now Joseph is collecting all the silver. It's a kind of look at me now moment. You know what I mean? I was once sold for silver, but now who's got it all? He's bringing it all in. He's putting it all into the treasury of Pharaoh. Verse 15, when the people of Egypt and Canaan ran out of money, all the Egyptians came to Joseph. Our money is gone, they cried. Please give us food or we will die before your very eyes. So now the silver's all gone. All the legal tender is gone. So Joseph's saying, well, what do you have? What could you trade for me to give you more food? So verse 16, Joseph replied, since your money is gone, bring me your livestock. I will give you food in exchange for your livestock. So they brought their livestock to Joseph in exchange for food, in exchange for their horses, flocks of sheep and goats, herds of cattle and donkeys. Joseph provided them with food for another year. So he starts taking in the livestock. He collected all the silver. Now he takes these assets that can produce sustainable products like cheese and milk and provide labor. But it's also interesting to note the detail we're given here in, for a second. It says he collected these animals, then lists them. Horses, sheep, goats, cattle, donkeys. It's a list of what he is collecting into the storehouses of Pharaoh. I told you a few weeks ago that this part of the story is actually mirroring the flood account from Genesis 6, you know, Noah's Ark. So the flood was a de-creation event. When God created, what are we told? He separated the land from the water. And that brought order out of the chaos of pre-creation. But in the flood, what happened? Water took over the whole land. It went back to a pre-creation time. It was a de-creation event. And so Noah had to build an ark, which is a big storage box, basically. And he collected food and he collected animals. And so here's Joseph in another de-creation event, except it's the opposite. It's not too much water, it's too little water. It's all land. There's no water to actually be able to produce anything in the land. And so the world is being devastated again. And what does Joseph do? He creates big storage units and fills them with food and animals, this list of animals that he is collecting. In a way, he's actually serving these poor creatures who would have been next on the dinner plate as Noah saved the animals from destruction. Verse 18, but that year ended, and the next year they came again and said, we cannot hide the truth from you, my Lord. Our money is gone, and all our livestock and cattle are yours. We have nothing left to give but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your very eyes? Buy us and our land in exchange for food. We offer our land and ourselves as slaves for Pharaoh. Just give us grain so we may live and not die, and so the land does not become empty and desolate. So one more trade comes to the table. The people have no more money to offer. They have no more livestock. So they come and say, all that we've got left is we can liquidate the value of our land and we can give ourselves as laborers for Pharaoh. So Pharaoh basically owns everything. He's got all the money. He's got all the livestock. He's got all the land. He's got all the people. Joseph has made Pharaoh into the richest man in the world. Now, here's what I'm thinking at this point in the story. And you might be thinking this as well. Like, this isn't good. This isn't a good system. This isn't good for people. I mean, putting them into poverty, taking their land, making them slaves, this feels like it's wrong, right? Joseph is supposed to be this image bearer to wisely rule. What's going on here? But just put a pin in that for a moment. Sometimes our modern Western views of democracy and welfare systems, which are good, very good, they get in the way of us understanding the point sometimes. The point isn't whether Joseph is setting up an economic or political system that we agree with or that we'd want to live in. The point is that this is revealing how wise Joseph has been. His foresight, the actions he's put into place, produced extreme abundance in the midst of extreme barrenness. That's Joseph's skill and wisdom. During a massive economic disaster, Joseph is actually producing abundance because he was prepared for it. And Pharaoh's probably sitting on his throne thinking like, I made the best decision of my life hiring this guy. Like, Pharaoh's doing nothing. He's just letting Joseph run things, and Pharaoh's just getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. If there's any business owners or bosses in the room, and you know what it's like when you've got that one employee who is just so skilled and so capable and just makes the business look really good and makes the business a ton of money and actually makes your life easier. You get to work less hours instead of more. And you think, man, I'm so glad I've got this person. That's what Pharaoh's thinking to the strongest degree with what Joseph is doing for his nation. That's the point the text is trying to make. God made his image bearers to be rulers, to govern wisely. The people weren't wise. The Canaanites weren't wise. The Egyptians weren't wise. Nobody except Joseph was wise, and his wisdom led to this incredible abundance. Verse 20, so Joseph brought all the land bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. All the Egyptians sold him their fields because the famine was so severe. Soon all the land belonged to Pharaoh. As for the people, he made them all slaves from one end of Egypt to the other. The only land he did not buy was the land belonging to the priests. They received an allotment of food directly from Pharaoh, so they didn't need to sell their land. This special deal for the priests actually foreshadows the Hebrew law, where the priests receive an allotment and they don't have property ownership, but they receive from the produce of the land and the tithes of the people. Verse 23, then Joseph said to the people, look today, I have bought you and your land for Pharaoh. I will provide you with seed so that you can plant the fields. Then when you harvest it, 1/5 of your crop will belong to Pharaoh. You may keep the remaining 4/5 as seed for your fields and as food for you, your households, and your little ones. You have saved our lives, they exclaimed. May it please you, my Lord, to let us be Pharaoh's servants. Joseph then issued a decree still in effect in the land of Egypt that Pharaoh should receive 1/5 of all the crops grown on his land. Only the land belonging to the priests was not given to Pharaoh. So the whole population becomes tenant farmers. Everyone's an employee of Pharaoh. They work Pharaoh's land. They're taxed 1/5 of the produce. The rest they can keep for themselves to eat and to plant more crops. And so I'm with you again with being a little bothered by this system, and you'll see the payoff at the end of this story. But listen to the response of the people. They weren't upset. They were actually thankful. You've saved our lives. Can we please be the slaves of Pharaoh? Like it was kind of their idea. They had a positive response. They were actually amazed at Joseph's wisdom of navigating through this terrible time. Imagine if you were a politician and you implemented a radical new economic policy where no one could own anything, and you enforced a 20% tax on all their labor, and the whole nation gathered together to say, thank you, you're incredible. The text is just trying to re-emphasize how wise Joseph was. Consider the fact that Noah, in the mirroring story, only saved 7 people, plus himself on the ark. Here, Joseph saved everyone. Like the alternate option was death, starvation. But I think what's happening here is that we're actually being set up to notice a contrast. We're going to notice a contrast between the fate of the Egyptians and the fate of God's people. And this is the payoff in the story for me. Notice the distinction we're about to see. Joseph set up this system for the Egyptians. At the same time, he was setting up a whole different deal for his whole family, for the people of Israel, the chosen people of blessing. Verse 27 says, meanwhile, so all this is happening with the Egyptians. Meanwhile, the people of Israel settled in the region of Goshen in Egypt. There they acquired property and they were fruitful and their population grew rapidly. So as we've gone through Genesis, we haven't done every single chapter or read every single verse. Just for the sake of time, we didn't want to be here for 9 years. But in chapter 46, in the beginning of chapter 47, we actually see Joseph negotiate a deal with Pharaoh to give his family a separate piece of land. Now, Joseph knew something that was a pattern in the book of Genesis, that every time God's people, who were called to be different, they were called to be set apart, they were called to stand out. Every time they integrated into the cities of people, like you think of Sodom and Gomorrah, and you think of other cities like Babel in the stories, the cities were a place of corruption. So when God's people integrated into the cities of the pagan peoples, they would actually be corrupted by the sin of the cities. And so Joseph knows this. He doesn't want his family to just come and be in the cities of Egypt. So he's setting up a separate place for them to live in a region called Goshen. And Goshen is a garden. It's a place of fruitfulness. It's a place of abundance. And they acquired property. The Egyptians weren't allowed to acquire property anymore. And we're told they were fruitful and they multiplied. Does this ring any bells? So the first family, Adam and Eve, they're placed in a garden, a beautiful paradise. And they're said, be fruitful. They're told, be fruitful and multiply. So here's this scene of God's people being rescued from devastation, rescued from decreation, rescued from sin, rescued from death, and they're brought into a paradise. And they're continuing to fulfill God's promise of blessing that they would be fruitful and they would multiply. They're experiencing the paradise of a new creation. The whole Genesis story, where did it start? It started in a garden. God's people placed there as his image bearers, a special people chosen by God to be blessed and to be a blessing to the world. It started there, but because of sin, God's people were exiled. They were cast out of the garden. But the hope was always that there would be a way back. How can we get back to the garden? We've been sent away, but the trajectory of exile is to return. How are we going to return? And human wickedness and sin continued to spiral out of control. It seemed like there was no hope and no hope and no hope, but God was still working out his plan. And his ultimate plan was to return the people to the garden. This is a picture of salvation. God's providence at work to rescue his people and bring them back into relationship with him. Bring them back into a place of peace and life and abundance. But listen, it's not because God's people have been especially wonderful. It's not because they were especially wise. Only Joseph in the whole world was especially wise. Maybe you could attribute some wisdom to Pharaoh because he put Joseph in position. It's not because they were any better than anybody else. It was because they had entered into a covenant relationship with a God who always fulfills his promises. God promised to bless his people. He promised that through his people, the world would be blessed. He told Abraham in chapter 12, I will bless you and turn you into a great nation. He said, anyone who blesses you will be blessed. So that's why Pharaoh's getting blessed right now, because all he's done has been kind and be a blessing to Abraham's family, now the great-grandchildren. But God is blessing this family of crooked, scheming scoundrels. We've read the stories. We've gone through this whole text. It's not because they're better than anybody else. It's not because they're wiser. It's not because they're more moral. In fact, the stories are probably helping convince us that the Egyptians might have been more moral people than the Israelites at this point. It's because God was fulfilling his promise that regardless of their lack of faithfulness, God remained faithful to his promises to bless them. So earlier I asked, what are you doing to prepare for your future? What are you doing to prepare for your future? You know, we need to save money. We need to invest. We need to put resources away for a rainy day. But I know there's a lot of people in this room and certainly a lot of people in our city who to that would say, how am I supposed to save and prepare if I'm just living paycheck to paycheck? The idea of saving, investing is just merely a dream. How can I prepare for a future when I can barely survive in the present? Or maybe your experience is that you're in a place right now where you're suffering because you didn't have the foresight when you had more than enough to prepare for a time when you didn't have enough. I think a big lesson we can take away from this part of the Joseph story is this. You might not have planned well for your future, but God has. You might not have planned well for your future, but God has a future in store for you. You might not have the wisdom and foresight of Joseph, but God has all wisdom and knows what's coming. God has always been wisely preparing for your future, whether you're in on it or not. And as we've looked at Joseph's story, we've come back again and again to this theme of providence. Let me define it for you one more time. It's God's ability to wisely guide the course of events toward his good purposes. God was at work this whole time through the suffering Joseph faced, through the brutality of his life, through the way in which he was betrayed, through everything, even through the scheming scoundrels of his family. God was working through all of that to bring about this future for his covenant people. Now, I've taken a long time to set up this point, and I hope you're with me. Notice, both the Egyptians and Joseph's family lacked the wisdom to prepare for the famine. They were in the exact same situation. They experienced the exact same suffering and anxiety and fear for their lives. And yet Joseph's family, God's chosen people, were given a way better deal, weren't they? Yeah, they got a way better deal. Doesn't it seem unfair? They got to live in the Garden of Goshen. They got to own property and keep their own produce. They got to thrive and multiply and live in freedom, while the Egyptians were slaves who owned nothing. And it wasn't because God's people were wiser. It wasn't because they were more moral. It wasn't because they were smarter or better looking or prayed harder or read their Bibles more. It was because they were in a covenant relationship with the God of all blessing. And you could look at it this way. The Egyptians of that day are like people in the world today who live apart from God. People who don't know God, who haven't put their faith in Jesus, but they live in a world that is blessed by God. This world is blessed by God. And people all over the world benefit from the goodness of God even if they don't acknowledge him. That's God's grace on the world. Sometimes people get provision in this life and they declare, yay, like the Egyptians, we can live and not die. We can live and not die. It's kind of a best case scenario. But their apparent salvation is at the expense of their liberty. They remain bound to the powers that command and control. The Egyptians remain bound to Pharaoh. People in this world remain bound to sin and death that command and control. Pharaoh's tightening noose on the Egyptians represented the lack of freedom of those who weren't a part of the covenant family, the family of God, the people of Israel, whereas the salvation of God's people, they received salvation offered to them. It was a totally different deal, wasn't it? It was a totally different deal. It wasn't because they were wiser or more moral or harder working or more spiritual. It was because they were in a relationship with a God who fulfills his promises. And he promised to bless them. Fast forward to the New Testament, to the arrival of Jesus and the salvation that comes through him. And Paul is reflecting on this in Ephesians chapter 2. He says, God saved you by his grace when you believed. He saved you. Think about the whole Joseph story. What they were being saved from, what they were being saved into. That's what God is doing through Jesus. By his grace. Now here's how I like to think about grace. On the one hand, I contrast it to the idea of mercy. Mercy is not getting what you do deserve. So let's say on your way home today, you're going a little too fast. And cop pulls you over and says, hey, you are going 75 in a 50 zone. That's a $300 ticket or something like that. And if that same police officer said, but I'm just going to let you off with a warning. What's that? That's mercy. You broke the law, you deserve the ticket, but the cop said, I'm not going to give you a ticket today. That's the cop showing you mercy. Now, if that same police officer said, and here's an ice cream cone on me, that ice cream cone is grace. Because not only did you not get what you do deserve, but now you're getting something you don't deserve, a blessing on top of mercy. You were saved by his grace when you believed. Just like the Israelites in Joseph's story, they didn't deserve anything. They didn't even deserve to be saved from starvation. They certainly didn't deserve to go into a garden of blessing and prosperity and production and multiplication. It's all God's grace because they were in a covenant relationship with him. Paul continues, you can't take credit for this. It is a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for the good things we have done. None of us can boast about it. Don't brag to the Egyptians as though you're better than them, because we're not. Sometimes we're worse. That's why we need God's mercy and his grace. God is preparing a future for us, even if we are unable to prepare for one ourselves. It's a future of abundance. It's a future of freedom. It's a future of fruitfulness. First Peter tells us that we have a priceless inheritance awaiting us in heaven. So there's the contrast. There's a false salvation that this world goes after. We can live and not die. It may allow you to breathe for a few years, but it actually continues to lead into bondage. But there's a true salvation that comes from God. There's a true salvation brought from heaven to earth where Jesus comes by his blood shed on the cross to offer you a salvation out of death and into life, out of darkness and into light. That regardless of what you're going through on this earth, regardless of your inability to prepare for your future, Trusting in him takes you into a future of eternal life, fills you with hope, floods you with the love of God, understanding his mercy and grace now, and ushering you into eternal life in your future. It's not based on whether you're an Egyptian or an Israelite. It's based on whether you have accepted the invitation to enter into a covenant relationship with the God who keeps his promises. He sent Jesus into the world like Joseph, but greater. Jesus' wisdom is displayed not just in temporarily saving us from starvation, but saving us from sin for eternity. Come to him. Like the people all over the world flocked to Joseph, come to Jesus. He will not take your silver and your livestock and turn you into a slave. He has paid the entire price for your salvation. Come to him and he will usher you freely into an abundant land of blessing for eternity. That's our Savior. As we looked through the opening chapters of Genesis a couple years ago now, I told you that, first of all, Genesis is a story of our origins. That God created a universe with purpose and intent and meaning for us to live in. That we are made in his image to rule and reign. But it's also a story of our identity. It's who we are, it's that as image bearers, but broken image bearers. That sin has broken things and messed everything up, and we struggle and suffer and have a hard time moving on ourselves. We've caused catastrophe in our own lives and in the world. The brokenness of decreation is because of the accumulation of human sin in God's creation. But Genesis is also a story of our destiny. It's our origins, it's our identity, and it's our destiny. God hasn't given up on us. God has chosen to bless us. Even though we continue to mess up on our end, God remains faithful. God has destined you and I for blessing. The blessing of salvation and eternal life through Jesus. So, have you prepared for your future? It's wise to put some money away if you can. But the most important preparation is to put your faith in Jesus. Put your future in his hands.
Thank you for listening to the APA podcast. We hope it helps you better follow Jesus in your home, city, and around the world.